You're listening to the Thoroughly Good Classical Music Podcast. My name is John Jacob. Schubert's epic and much-revered song cycle Die Schöne Mölerin is given a folksy feel with a new recording released by Rubicon Classics, featuring baroque soloists and Thomas Guthrie, who you'll hear in this podcast episode. If you're a fan of deference, then this one probably isn't for you. But if you're open, curious, or in need of a fresh approach, then come on in, find yourself a bale of straw, and sit yourself down. It's a treat.
Das Wandern ist des Müllers Lust, das Wandern. Das Wandern ist des Müllers Lust, das Wandern. Das muss ein schlechter Müller sein, dem niemals fiel das Wandern ein. Das Wandern, das Wandern, das Wandern, das Wandern.
I think that as I get older, I realise that it's more fun to do what you think than what other people might expect. But I think I've a very well brought up boy. I think I enjoy the rebellious side of things. I honestly don't seek to shock. I, as a director, I'm very keen to just be good at storytelling. But you see, I think that Schubert is what we did on the recording is much more like what he. Who knows? But of what he might have had in mind or expected people to kind of do than going to the Wigmore Hall and hearing someone very impressively perhaps just recite the whole cycle, you know, with this big grand piano and a kind of this air of sanctity and only for the few who perhaps know it and can compare their recordings with the, you know, that's so far from what I think was going on. So if rebellion is about putting things straight when you know when they're not, then I put a whole hand up that I don't assume that he wanted it or thought it would ever be arranged for two guitars and a three drives and so on, but the point is that he would have said yeah do something with it, and I think that that idea that this group that I've had the great joy of working with for 12 13 years now, you know, if they're the people you're working with and you want to do some of this stuff, then do it with them. I wanted to stage the Bach motets for the Spitalfields Festival in 2014, and I just wanted to do that, and then I discovered that Bach motets were written for funerals.
Ihr Blümlein, alle, die sie mir gab, euch soll man legen mit Mühe ins Grab. Wie sieht ihr?
But they were actually funeral music. So someone would die, and Bach, if he knew them, he would write this piece of music to be sung at their funeral, which is, I thought, was a huge thing. That this, you know, Bach was. This is his response to our mortality, and so in the process of staging those, I had been working for about 4 years with the Baroque Solistener and the Ehrhaus project, and I wanted some music to go in between the Bach motets. So I invited them over for this gig, and then I realised that it was about death, and I thought, well, what would be great is to have an Ehrhaus session at the end of the evening, which would work as a kind of wake. The Bach motets would be the sort of funeral bit, and we needed a death. We needed a character to die. So rather than sacrificing anybody actually on stage, we thought, well, let's do the Schubert. And because they were there, I thought, well, I'll get them involved. And the first arrangement, this was back in 2014, we did it with a puppet to kind of really emphasise, I'd done puppetry with Schubert before, Winterreiser. And there's a wonderful thing that happens with the puppet in Schöne Mölerin, which is when, in the penultimate song, you let go of it. And it was hung, this puppet, and it just swung gently. So it was very clear, and it was being clear and then having a little break and having a drink and then having some Bach motets felt like a nice thing to do. But the original arrangement was only for guitar with sort of colour put in. And then Beata said to me, this is great. Can you give us a bit more to do?
Es also gemeint, mein rauschender Freund, dein Singen, dein Klingen, war es
It's interesting storytelling, isn't it? I mean, it's such a basic thing, such a basic human thing, and it's a lovely thing, right? It's the fireside at the end of the day. It's the thing that that binds people together. It's the thing that gives people a break, gives you a chance just to kind of forget about things for a bit and be taken off somewhere. I mean, we sit down and watch a film or a Netflix series. It's escapism, isn't it, to a certain extent, and relaxation. But we also learn stuff, and then we might get on Facebook and say, "Did you see Succession last night?" Whatever it is, and there's a kind of group of people who it forms bonds and identity. I think, there's so much written about this, isn't there? It's the value, the importance of storytelling, and to me, that's it. When I was young, when I was about 4 or 5, I have a very clear memory of being at home and sitting by the literally by the fire, my back to the fire, surround, and the room was unusually full of people. I remember it being unusually full of people, a nice sort of evening thing. And I remember my dad telling a story. And I just remember that. I think that moment has been quite, I realised. And actually, when I was cycling back from a Lewisham Creative Chorus workshop one Saturday morning, I had that memory come very strongly. And I thought, that could explain it.
Hat sie dich geschickt, oder hast mich berückt? Das möchte ich noch wissen, ob sie dich geschickt, ob sie dich geschickt. Nun, wie es auch mag sein, ich gebe mich drein, was ich suche, ich wunden, wie es immer mag sein.
But to me, so I'm very, what's the word? Well, I was going to say fortunate, but also probably annoying. But in that I do these lots of different things, and to people say, it's been definitely leveled as a criticism before. For instance, puppeteering and singing at the same time. You know, doesn't it make you much worse at singing and not that good at puppeteering because you're doing two things at once? And this idea that direct or arrange or compose and perform, they do feel very, very much one thing to me. I just like getting involved with storytelling and engaging with an audience. And if you're doing a Schubert cycle, it's a story, isn't it? And so how do you make that? It's interesting with puppets because what I discovered with puppets, and again, I'm not the first to do this people write about this, but I find it works so well with what I love about storytelling, which is that your imagination is set free. And with the right, when you're reading a great book or the right theatrical experience, it's not about being told what to think and told, it's about finding your own resonance. And puppets do that brilliantly with music. And I've done some shows, I've done Orfeo, I've done Dido with puppets, completely with puppets. And what I find is the audience are so quiet. And the music goes in sort of so directly because they're going, oh my God, is that real? Is it? And the whole atmosphere is heightened because their imagination is tweaked, is pricked into active service. And that's where the music can really hit home, I think. Of course, there's a choice there for the audience too. And it doesn't always work. And you need some charm, I think, and you need some skill in terms of lighting, say, or things. You need to kind of invite people in because you are asking them to do quite a lot of work. People can refuse. People can say, creepy. I don't want to do that. And so it's a risk, I think. But if you can do it in a relaxed enough way and an inviting enough way and an enchanting enough way, I think it can be a really nice way. And of course, it's not definitive. There's nothing lovely way to try and do this thing. And what is that thing? It's storytelling. Thank you.
Ich schnitt es gern in alle Rinden ein, ich grüb es gern in jeden Kieselstein. Ich möchte sehen auf jedes frische Beet, mit Kressensamen, der es schnell verrät. Auf jeden weißen Zettel möchte ich schreiben, frei ist mein Herz, frei ist mein Herz, und soll es ewig, ewig bleiben.
I have to say straight off that I mean, I love doing it. I love the process for me of arranging it and then working with wonderful colleagues who feed back. And I mean, broadly, they fed back. It's interesting because
they make it sound as though somebody was in the background going, "Fuck, no, this is not going to work, is it?"
There was one case, I think it was Ungeduld, which is the seventh song, it's Impatience, appropriately enough, and we did it. And it was one of the ones I hadn't kind of revisited for a long time, and it was just a bit shit. Yeah, and they got to the end and they're going, and so we had the gig the next day, and I went back to my hotel room. We were in, I think we were in Norway or Denmark, and I think it was Denmark, and I wrote another one, and I got about 2 hours into it, and the computer crashed and lost it all, and so then I had to do it. But it was interesting because the way it's ended up, and I, you know, I wrote it for them, you know, so the double bass has a great part. So I really enjoyed the process. It's just, I think it's really important to challenge that grand piano sacred thing about this music. It's not what it's really due. And also maybe, you know, it was a choice to sing this recording myself. Because there are just great singers who can sing this. The reason I did is because I partly wanted to approach it in a way which was not. Gotta be careful what I say here.
Carry on. Don't worry. I'm offering you the floor. Yeah, you carry on. No,
but I'm a trained singer. I've sung at the Wigmore Hall. I've sung around the world. I've sing with the Airhouse Boys and stuff. So I don't want to sort of put myself down. But I'm not that animal that just does that, and they are brilliant people who do that, and I don't want to steal their place in this process, but I did want to sing it in a way which doesn't have that baggage if possible. And I thought I had the possibility to do that, so I think there is, you go back to Rebellion, I think there is a challenge in this that we want to say to people, you know, this. And the feedback I get from, you know, largely from my friends, because they use the word accessible, and I think that when you hear strings and double bass and a little bit of sort of percussive noise, or it says this isn't what you expect. This is something that you're invited to come and listen to the story, really. Das Land on the first song is there's a video of us sort of doing a jamming version, which is slightly different to one on the album, which is more scored. It's got a similar sort of beat, but it's a bit more straight in, and it's got very clear, yeah. So it is scored. The players, the Brooks listener, always ornament it, always bring their own colour to it. But it's funny, my theatrical training, as it were, my the discipline I think required to really stick to the story and not. I mean, it's this, going back to Schubert himself talking about ornamentation and other people talking about ornamentation. It was expected. They really expected it. And there's, I don't know if you know the. There's an eight. I've got it right here. The 1830 edition of Die Schöne Müllerin.
Oh Lord!
So 2 years after Schubert died, 6 years after it was written, it's as sung by Vogel, who was an opera singer at the time, but was a sort of patron of Schubert. You know, patronized him in pretty well every way, I think. But was a well known singer, and it is noticeably different. He puts bars rest in when he needs a bit more time. He changes the piano accompaniment sometimes. There's no question he expects it to be. I mean, like, and you know, going back to the Brock period, of course, just as a term of reference, they don't put much information in the score. They sometimes put dynamics, but there's no tempo marking often. That, you know, sometimes they do if it's a really key thing, point they want to make. The expectation of the performer is you're going to go and make this work. And that is that continued well into the 19th century. I mean, Schubert was taught in that classical method of where rhetoric was a half writing and half performance, half. So the half of the responsibility, that's what this really shows, that it's not that they were expected to it and we've come away from that. We've got done it less and less and less. So a lot of the ornaments that I do, vocal ornaments, are in here. And I do some other ones as well, but there's some beautiful ones that he's written in that 1830 edition. But to go back to the scoring, yeah, in terms of the discipline of the storytelling, to work with a group of people who maybe don't know the story, I wrote quite a lot of, tried to amuse them, but of stage instructions in the thing, like the Liebe Farbe, when he's really, try not to cry when you play this, and that pray like you want her to come back, like you want to pull her air. So keeping the discipline of the storytelling was important, so it didn't just become a musical festival. And I think that to go back to the very beginning of Lieder, people always sang songs, for goodness sake, and Homer sang the Odyssey, didn't, so the idea of a sort of song recital is so basic and fundamental. But in the late 18th century, when this sort of genre was growing up of people singing songs with a basic keyboard instrument in their front rooms and bringing other instruments and playing with it, but sort of telling stories in the front rooms, was almost a way of selling text. So poems, it's like getting a free binder with a new magazine. You know, if you got or decorating a manuscript with illustration, you don't just get the text, you get something which makes it just sell a bit better. If you've got a tune with a text, oh, great, you might buy it. But it was all about disseminating text and story and poetry. So we've got to start with a text and then see what Schubert did with it and then just amplify that a little bit.
Ich hört ein Bächlein rauschen wohl aus dem Felsenquell. Hinab zum Tale rauschen, so frisch und wunderhell. Ich weiß nicht, wie mir wurde, nicht wer den Rat mir gab. Ich musste auch hinunter mit meinem Wanderstab. Ich musste auch hinunter mit meinem Wanderstab.
A conversation I heard on the radio around the time of the Labour conference recently about talking about infrastructure and rebuilding, building new towns and so on. And I was thinking, great, where's the culture going to be in this? Where's the theatre? How does it work? How does it fit with schools? And how does it? But there was a conversation with, I can't remember who was presenting, probably Shadow Health Secretary, about AI, and this of course is a huge topic at the moment again. But the question from the journalist was, what if you're an 18-year-old who's spent the last 5 years thinking, okay, I'm interested enough in maths and I'm going to learn how to be a coder. And now I get to the point where clearly AI is going to do that much quicker, much more efficiently than me. What do you say to that person? And he said, well, it's an interesting comment. And then he made some rough remark, I think, to begin with. But he said, there's no doubt that we are going to need more creative thinkers in the future, that the future is going to be about creative thinking. This was the same week that Rishi Sunak announced that everyone was going to do maths. It was that kind of skills-based thing. What you're talking about there is what really unleashes further skills and the motivation to do them. It's not that we don't need skills, it's that we need people with their own voice and their own thinking. And that's what is desperately important, that we don't lose. And funny enough, just to bring it back to the Schubert, I mean, in a sense, that's what he's expecting. He just did not want people to go, ooh, what did he mean? Well, I'm going to do exactly what he said. That's not it at all. I mean, that would be wrong.
Lass singe Sellers rauschen und wandre fröhlich nach, fröhlich nach, fröhlich nach.
You've been listening to the Thoroughly Good Classical Music Podcast. Follow at Thoroughly Good on X, at Thoroughly_Good on Instagram, and search on Google for the blog and Thoroughly Good on Substack.